from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Demonstrators marched in Oakland and San Francisco over the weekend to protest the deadly violence at a rally of white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia on Saturday. 20-year-old James Alex Fields Jr. was arrested on suspicion of second-degree murder and other charges after driving his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing a 32-year-old paralegal named Heather Heyer. President Trump condemned the hatred and violence, quote, on many sides, but he is under heavy criticism for failing to strongly denounce white supremacy by name. We'll talk about the incident, the white supremacist movement, and we'll open the phone lines to get your reactions. It's coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Bail has been denied for the Ohio man accused of ramming his car into a crowd of Charlottesville protesters and killing one woman and injuring 19. 20-year-old James Alex Fields Jr., who is being held on suspicion of second-degree murder, was part of a Unite the Right rally organized Saturday by white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and affiliates of the alt-right movement. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said this morning that the attack, quote, meets the definition of domestic terrorism. But President Trump, who on Twitter denounced hatred and violence, quote, on many sides, remains under heavy criticism for failing to call out and condemn white supremacy by name. We'll discuss the rally, its aftermath, and the white nationalist movement in the United States in this forum hour. Joining us in studio is Eva Patterson, president and co-founder of Equal Justice Society. And welcome, Eva.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Peter Simi is with us this morning from Orange, California. He's professor of sociology at Chapman University, which is located there, and author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Welcome, Professor Simi.
Thank you. Thanks.
Good to have you. Also good to have Sahil Kapoor, who's national political reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's with us from the nation's capital. And Sahil Kapoor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin with you. President Trump is under pressure now, but no tweets from him except about the resignation of Kenneth Frazier earlier, who was on his manufacturing group, CEO, African-American CEO of Merck Corporation. He's getting it from many sides, including from his own Republicans, about the necessity to speak out and actually condemn specifically rather than many sides. Is he not?
That's correct. President Trump is getting a lot of criticism from within his own party for the failure to pointedly condemn the white supremacists, the white nationalists, KKK, and neo-Nazi sympathizers. Call them what you want, but he did not name the evil that was on display in Charlottesville, and he's getting criticism from members of his own party, including Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, a former primary rival who ended up supporting him in the general election. There's Senator Cory Gardner, who runs the Senate Republican campaign arm, said the president needs to be more forceful and call this by its name. He said white supremacy has no place in this country, and these people are not welcome in the Republican base. The president, intriguingly, is never shy about being blunt and specifically calling out people and actions by name. Today we saw that with the Merck CEO. A few months ago, he even called out Nordstrom for stopping, for no longer selling his daughter's clothing brand. That is how blunt he is usually, which is why members of his party are a little bit baffled and mystified by his refusal to pointedly condemn the white nationalists in Charlottesville.
Lindsey Graham said these groups feel they have a friend in the White House. I also added, that is, Lindsey Graham added, that perhaps the president should dissuade them of that, but he seems not necessarily so inclined. And one has to ask, what is he afraid of here? What is he concerned about, that he's going to lose his base because so many of them were out there in his name?
This is the issue here. There are two theories behind this. One, which many Republicans are espousing, is that this is a failed, a missed opportunity by the president to unite the country, which they say would have been very easy to do. The other theory is that the president is deliberately, refraining from the type of condemnation, the type of forceful condemnation that people in his party and outside his party, frankly, are calling for. My colleague Josh Green in Business Week wrote a book about Steve Bannon and the president's chief strategist, and he interviewed him for this, and he asked him about President Trump's, then-candidate Trump's failure to pointedly condemn the KKK and David Duke and neo-Nazis. And what Bannon said was, I'm quoting here, we polled the race stuff and it doesn't matter. It doesn't move anyone who isn't already in her camp. So it's, unquote. So it's possible the president is looking at this purely from a cold political standpoint and he thinks that, you know, that these people would continue. These people at least are sympathetic to him and maybe doesn't want to lose those sympathies.
Well, the alt-right movement was certainly identified and continues to be identified in many ways with Stephen Bannon, who, Breitbart said he better not be removed from his position or else they're going to come down with wrath on the president. And there have been those kind of threats and caveats or whatever you want to call them. But the reality is that Bannon is under big fire now for leaks and whatnot. And there's been a lot of speculation, a lot of buzz that he may be on his way out.
That's true, but that's been the case for months. There's always some sort of rumor coming out from the White House about this person or that person potently on the ropes or whatever. The latest thing we see is that Bannon is in a seeming cold war with H.R. McMaster on the president's national security staff. They see things differently. There's been a kerfuffle about Bannon initially having a seat on that and then getting kicked off of that. McMaster would not say over the weekend when asked several times on NBC's Meet the Press whether he can see himself working with Steve Bannon. So, yes, you know, there are a number of warring ideological camps in the White House. And Steve Bannon, back when he did run Breitbart, he called Breitbart the platform for the alt-right.
Sahil Kapoor is national political reporter with Bloomberg News. And Eva Patterson here with us in studio is president and co-founder of Equal Justice Society. And Eva and I were talking before we went on the air a bit about the differences that seem to exist between some of these extremists. I mean, Nazis on the one hand, white nationalists on the other. You had an experience with a friend who identified herself as a white nationalist recently.
My friend Terry may be listening today because she is here in San Francisco. She voted for Obama twice, and yesterday she told me that she is a white nationalist because she feels that white people have been browbeaten by people of color and that they feel guilty about being white and they don't want to feel that way again. But here's the more important problem. I don't think this is just a machination on the part of Trump. Think of how he got into the political arena. He started with this nonsense birther analysis, trying to make sure that people didn't really think our first African-American president was really an American. He also was very much for giving the death penalty for the Central Park men who were falsely accused of raping and pillaging and were ultimately exonerated. He's never apologized for that.
That was the Wilding incident that many people remember, yeah.
That the African-Americans had nothing to do with. Look at his rallies where he said, beat them up, rough them up. I will have them. I will pay for their legal fees. Alt-right, all these terms are a way of kind of ignoring the notion that there's white supremacy abroad in the land. And Trump has been very careful not to call out white supremacists. The Daily Stormer, which is the publication of the neo-Nazis, said very carefully, look, Trump did not condemn us. And they felt very emboldened by Trump not criticizing white supremacists.
Forgive me, they also said, God bless him.
Exactly, exactly. And remember, the Trump administration has decided not to look at the extremist views of white supremacists. They pulled that program away from any examination. So he's giving clear signals that he believes that people of color can be disregarded and that white supremacists are part of his base. More importantly, I think it's important, and this is my friend Howard Moore pointed this out to me yesterday. The Republican Party, since about 1970, has been trading on trying to make white people afraid of people of color. They had the Southern Strategy, where the Republican Party took over the South, whereas before 1964 and the Civil Rights Act, the Republican Party was really not seen as very powerful in the South. Lee Atwater in 1981 said, Republicans can't say nigger, 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 but we can talk about law and order. So the Republican Party has been very much trading on trying to make a wedge between white folks and the Democratic Party with people of color as the villain. This is kind of reaping the wild harvest of these policies that have been going on for decades.
And what do you make of the fact that this was actually the catalyst for this was concern about a statue of Robert E. Lee coming down in Charlottesville? I mean, as if Well, effacing history, I suppose, from one's point of view, is the wrong thing to do. And there are many who are not necessarily sympathetic with these groups who are concerned about that. You know, we got to get rid of anything with Jefferson, Washington, Woodrow Wilson, because they were segregationists, racists, owned slaves, et cetera, as opposed to, you know, just a movement that is, and we'll talk about the movement with Professor Simi, but a movement which seems to be focused on hatred.
I've read information that leads me to conclude that all the Confederate statues were put up in the 1960s, not the 1860s. And it was pretty much a signal to civil rights activists, look, we want you people are going too far. We're going to raise the Confederate flag again. As a black person, when I see the Confederate flag, I see a flag that stands for kidnapping Africans, enslaving us, raping us, having us work for no money. I see no glory in the Confederacy. I think kind of latching onto the Robert E. Lee statue was just a cover for white supremacy. Now, my buddy Terry, who's maybe listening to this, says being a white nationalist doesn't mean you're a white supremacist. That's hard for me to deal with. I'll take her at her word. But there were avowed white supremacists there in Charlottesville. This young man who ran Ms. Heyer over, apparently according to his high school teacher, was very much saying that white people are superior to people of color.
He was also standing with the Vanguard group holding a shield and so forth. But that's going to be a whole mess trying to prove a hate crime here because it was a white woman who was killed.
I think it's terrorism because you're trying to use violence to shape a political discussion. I think it is a hate crime because you're hating white people who are in favor of rights for people of color. I haven't read the statute, but I'm pretty sure you can make a hate crime.
Some of these groups, like your friend, make separations. I mean, they say, Eva, you're my friend, but other people of color are, you know, getting too much and doing too much against my interests as a white person, or they're leading to my extinction as a race. And again, we'll talk with Professor Simi about this. And it seems as if there's a kind of separation in many of these minds. I mean, the Nazi groups even condemn the Jews, but they love Trump, and Trump is, you know, has a Jewish daughter-in-law, he has a Jewish son-in-law, Stuart Miller, who is one of his major advisors, along with Jared Kushner. And Stephen Miller, and Gary Cohen. I mean, there seems to be kind of a separation here between the individuals and the whole group, especially among these white nationalists.
The white nationalists, I'm just learning about this, and I have to take my friend Terry at her word. She says white nationalists are not white supremacists. I don't buy that, but her view is that white people are tired of being browbeaten by people like me who are pushing for black rights. They think Black Lives Matter is a terror organization. I don't get it, and to me, there's not much difference between white nationalism and white supremacy, but my friend seems to think there is. So it's like, I like you, Eva. We went to slumber parties when we were in eighth grade, but you're just talking about race a little bit too much. It's very hard to deal with this, but there are people out there who think they are colorblind, yet they feel that it's okay to be white and they want to. She said, I'm proud to be a white person. She may call in today. It'll be interesting to hear from her.
No, I voted for Obama is the argument, too,
exactly.
Isn't it? Let me go to Peter Simi on this again. He's professor of sociology at Chapman and author of a book called American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. This was supposed to be united right, this whole march in Charlottesville, Professor Simi. But are they split? Are they factionalized in the way that perhaps Eva's suggesting?
Well, yeah, certainly there are factions within any social movement. There's factions in this movement.
But I mean particularly in terms of where their animus is or their hatred, yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. Some groups are more focused on anti-Semitism, and really they talk about this so-called ZOG, Zionist Occupational Government, and they talk about this worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Other groups may be focused more on kind of anti-Muslim sentiments and really focusing on this idea that Muslims are, you know, this violent threat, you know, across the globe and trying to essentially eradicate, Western Christian culture and civilization. So, yeah, you do have some splits in terms of how they focus, but I think Eva's touched on a number of things that really kind of unite them in terms of this idea that, you know, whiteness is under attack and that, you know, you shouldn't feel guilty to be white and you should be, you know, be able to, everybody else is proud of their race or ethnicity. Why shouldn't whites? And that whites are on the verge of extinction and so forth. So those are some things that do kind of unite across. many of these groups.
Well, I was looking at an editorial from the National Review, and I want to read part of it because it's relevant here. It says, the rally in question was advertised as a project to unite the right. We flatter ourselves that we have a little something to say about that, because they've often been identified, of course, as being on the right. And our answer is no. We do not wish to be united with Jew haters, bigots, racists, and the morally and intellectually defective specimens on such sad display in Charlottesville, waving their Nazi banners and Confederate flags. There's a real sense of their separating themselves here in terms of something that was billed as uniting the right.
Well, yeah, I mean, unite the right, you know, sounds good, right? That, in some ways, that's public relations because, you know, it sounds legitimate, kind of mainstream political effort. And then that's, you know, common among a lot of these groups is they want to kind of reframe the discussion and make things sound more, kind of make themselves sound more legitimate, mainstream, and try and tap into a larger, you know, ability to kind of connect with people and try and recruit people from a broader, you know, swath of the population. And so, you know, they talk about heritage as opposed to hate. But underlying it, you don't have to go too far where you start to see what we're really talking about here. We're talking about white supremacy, not white nationalism, and I'm not sure how to distinguish between the two anyways, because white nationalism often involves separating whites or putting people at some kind of you know, subordinate position to whites. So I don't see the real distinction there between nationalism and supremacy in that respect.
Well, we have 79 hate groups in California, the highest in the United States, and the most hate crimes in the United States are in California. And you, Professor Simi, spent a number of years with these groups. You kind of presented yourself as being sympathetic, which is one way of at least finding what they're all about. You found that they're all about, a lot of them are all about violence. You spent, I think, 7 years in the field. A lot of them are about violence and hatred.
Well, yeah, violence is important. I mean, the ideas themselves are laced with violence oftentimes. Many members are involved in violence themselves, certainly far more violent talk than there is actual violent action, which is, you know, often the case in any type of extremist group. Violence plays a central role in how they see the world, and they see violence as a form of self-defense, essentially. And again, this comes back to this idea that, you know, whites are under attack. And so, you know, this manifests itself in everything from, you know, predatory acts of violence on the streets to, you know, much more organized actual plots of violence like we saw in Oklahoma City, or individual members commit, like Dylann Roof, who, you know, walked into a church and essentially assassinated members of this historically African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, to start the race war. Now, remember, that was his motive, was, mm-hmm. you know, he was very clear about that he wanted to try and start the race war. So, you know, you get a broad spectrum of the violence, but it certainly is very central to these groups.
So, Eva Patterson, what are your thoughts, as you reflect upon it, about these groups saying, you know, we're being deprived of our rights, we're ethnocentric and chauvinistic about our own group, the way that black people are, not only black lives should matter, our lives should matter. I mean, you hear these arguments, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. How do you respond to them?
Well, very few white people are afraid when a policeman stops them. If you know any black people, you know they've all had the talk with their kids. The white parents don't have the talk with their kids about being afraid of being stopped by the police. I am a senior citizen black woman, and I'm afraid of being stopped by the police. There was a Andrew Hacker is a professor in the East Coast, and he had a very interesting question of his students. He said, if you knew at midnight you were going to be turned black, how much money would you need? Now, if things are colorblind and if white people are really the most depressed, they'd go, I don't need any money. They're going like $1 million, $2 million. I would ask those white nationalists, do you think your life would be different if you were black? And if they're honest, I'm sure they know their lives would be diminished in many ways if they were black. Here's something else I want to talk about. We're talking a lot about the far right of the Republican Party, but look at the people who aren't carrying torches. They're trying to eliminate race consciousness in college admissions. They're trying to keep people out of the country who don't speak English. They're for a Muslim ban. There are all kinds of things that are done without tiki torches that are very detrimental to people of color. And the Republican Party has been doing this consciously for years. So I think the white nationalist people, they're not the most aggrieved people in society. That's just ridiculous. I'm sorry that they feel that way. If they think we as people of color are going to stop pushing for our rights, they're just wrong. But I believe somebody like Trump has given them the ability to think they're the most oppressed people in society. This really started in the Reagan administration when the Office of Civil Rights said that white men are the most biased, are the victims of the most bias in our society. So this isn't just people ramming folks with cars. There are more subtle ways of harming people of color, and the Republican Party has embraced that.
Reagan administration also brought in that figure of the welfare mother and, you know, living off of the taxpayer money and
Precisely.
So forth. Again, Eva Patterson is president and co-founder of the Equal Justice Society. Let's go back to Sahil Kapoor, who's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. And Sahil, FBI and DOJ are going to do an investigation into this from a civil rights standpoint. And Jeff Sessions, the AG, has been talking in strong terms, a lot of the kind of terms that people would like to hear from the president. What do you expect to see?
It's a good point. And Attorney General Sessions did condemn this pretty strongly. He called this an unequivocally unacceptable and evil attack that cannot be accepted in America, unquote. And yes, the DOJ is going to investigate this. One of the people, interestingly, calling for an investigation of this as domestic terrorism was Senator Ted Cruz, the runner-up in the Republican primary to Donald Trump. So he's one of the many voices in the Republican Party that are pushing further out on something like this. I want to bring a little bit of news here. The White House has told reporters that President Trump is scheduled to be giving some remarks in the White House. He's taken an unscheduled, a previously unscheduled trip back to D.C. For a day, and it remains to be seen what he'll say. But obviously, the expectation is he might want to expand on his remarks.
Yeah, he's going to be talking pretty soon, in fact, is the expectation, isn't it? We're coming up on it.
Yes, any moment now.
Yeah. Again, Sahil Kapoor is national political reporter for Bloomberg News. I want to bring you, our listeners, into this discussion. I know many of you have strong sentiments and also questions about what happened in Charlottesville and what the aftermath is likely to be, and certainly the concern about the president speaking more specifically about these hate groups. I do invite you to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The toll-free number to do that, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, so feel free, again, to join the program. Toll-free, you can do that now at 866-733-6786. And there are other ways that you can become involved in this program and become part of it. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A few comments here. Anastasia says, may I just remind Bay Area folks not to expand the racial implication of what's going on over there to here? We don't live in the South where people are daily enduring such racial hatred. I'd like to think we're better than that. Well, we'll get into some of that when we return. In fact, we've got a local reporter who has some things to say. Bert Johnson has been following the other demonstrations going on here in the Bay Area in San Francisco and Oakland. Stay tuned for that. Eva Patterson with us in studio, president and co-founder of Equal Justice Society. Peter Simi also with us, professor of sociology at Chapman University, author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate, and Sally Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking about Charlottesville, and particularly the aftermath of Charlottesville, with Eva Patterson here in studio with us, president and co-founder of the Equal Justice Society, and Peter Simi, a professor of sociology, who's written a book about right-wing movement and right-wing groups called American Swastika, and Sahil Kapoor, who's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. We want to bring Bert Johnson into this before we go to your calls and emails. He's contributor for KQED News, and Bert, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've been talking to Nathan Domingo, who was a founder of the California-based Identity Europa, and he's a former Marine and was convicted of a felony. He lives in Stanislaus County. He's also credited with actually helping to lead the Charlottesville rally. You spoke to him in April following a white supremacist rally that he led in Berkeley, and let's hear what he had to say.
Well, I'm going to be brutally honest. I think, for one, we'll get more publicity out of it. The more these people kick and scream and whine and cry, the more publicity we get. Publicity is a good thing from a PR perspective. We want people to talk about us. And if people aren't talking about us, then that's pretty much the worst thing that can happen.
PR. Any good PR is good PR. That seems to be the ethos of that young man. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. He and other members of the far right and, you know, particularly people affiliated with other white nationalist groups and white supremacist groups like his have been sort of actively seeking confrontation during these well-publicized rallies and protests.
But then they give the counter-argument that the counter-protesters are also looking for confrontation. And they, I mean, they have, in Charlottesville, they had a lot more arms. But, for example, in Berkeley, you had these black-hooded folks with masks and everything who were, you know, sowing a great deal of violence, too.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, people, counter-protesters associated with leftist groups have also contributed to the, you know, to the national attention on these public events. But I think that it's really important to keep in mind that these far right groups are actively goading their opponents into reacting in this way. So it's sort of part of their their plan to get attention on a national scale.
Didn't you find out from Domingo that what was happening at Berkeley with Yiannopoulos speaking was kind of a trial run?
Well, the protests against Milo Yiannopoulos' appearance were in some ways a catalyst for later events. But when you get to the free speech rallies like the one on April 15th and the one on April 27th, at that point, yes, they're definitely starting to use these events as a trial run, as a way to test out this approach of goading their opponents into really strongly opposing them in public. And they're also using these events as opportunities to recruit new members.
So tell us what happened over the weekend. You had a number of counter, what would be called counter-protesters, I mean protesters against racism and so forth, walking around Lake Merritt. They shut down I-580 too.
Yeah, that's right. I think the crowd estimates were about 500 people, but I was there covering the event with Alyssa John Perry and also with John Sepulvedo, and I can tell you that these events and the subsequent one I went to yesterday in the afternoon were largely really peaceful solidarity rallies.
Was there some spray painting, though, on concrete? At least that was what was reported, and fireworks set off?
Yeah,
along with stopping traffic, we should add.
Yeah. Right, of course. Yeah, they did block traffic in both directions on I-580 near Lake Merritt. And I definitely saw some fireworks get set off, a couple of smoke bombs. But it should be noted that those fireworks were being shot straight in the air in previous protests this year. There's been some use of fireworks as offensive weapons.
Again, talking with Bert Johnson, excuse me, who is contributor to KQED News, I was going to ask you something more that you could tell us about Domingo, what you got from that interview with him, or what people in the listening audience should know about Domingo.
Yeah, so one of the most important things to know about Nathan Domingo, he's sort of affiliated with, you know, what we're calling the alt-right, which is sort of this recently resurgent branch of white nationalist organizing.
Isn't he with a specific Europa group that wants to be set apart from everybody else?
Yeah, that's right. He's the founder of Identity Europa. He lives, of course, here in California, and that's where he began his group. But they're allies and collaborators with the National Policy Institute, which is the organization that Richard Spencer runs.
And you can find Bert's article on Domingo, on our website, kqed.org/forum. Future rallies planned in the Bay Area?
Yeah, there are a couple of rallies being planned by people associated with the far right on August 26th and 27th. The one on the 27th is being planned for the same park in downtown Berkeley, the Civic Center Park there.
Bert, thanks for your good work. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can I add something?
Ava Patterson.
I was on Twitter and people said it's interesting that the right is coming to Berkeley. They're too afraid to come to Oakland because we don't play in Oakland. So I just want to put that out.
Well, thank you for that, Eva. Thank you, Bert. We're going to go to some of your calls. Let me go to some comments first. A listener writes, Donald Trump's response was wrong and condones violent actions. It represents a real disrespect and disregard to the loss of life of the innocent victims as well. Totally shameful. And here are some other points of view. Joe writes, I don't have a problem with what Trump said. As a black conservative, I find it really hard to just have a decent conversation with a liberal here in California without being labeled a sellout or backwards. Both sides can share some blame and both sides have to make a decision. Is this as far as it goes or does it just escalate from here? And another listener says, it only gets violent when Antifa, Black Lives Matter, communists, and leftists show up. Let me go to your phone calls and let's begin with Cleveland. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I was just wondering, the first time in history that I was ever even able to see somebody who could stand within 100 yards of the president with a high-powered rifle was when there was a black president, right? All of a sudden, there's a crowd of people standing there with high-powered rifles letting him know. And, you know, we'll martyr ourselves if you say the wrong thing. I live in Palo Alto. I was on your show before with Kamala Harris, because I've had the Palo Alto police themselves try to plant crack on me on three separate occasions, and on three separate occasions tell me they're the Ku Klux Klan. And Kamala Harris told me, well, if you have a complaint like that, then you go talk to the police review person, which was LaDora Cordell, who was actually married to the police chief who was fired for using a racial epithet. So now LaDora Cordell is the person that you would go to in Santa Clara County. She's not just in Palo Alto anymore. She's the whole Santa Clara County police liaison.
All right, Cleveland, let me cut to the chase here, and I want to go with your comment to our guest, Sahil Kapoor, who's with us from Washington, Bloomberg News. What about the weapons in Charlottesville, Sahil? I mean, you know, there was some sense that the protesters had a lot more weapons even than the police, and the police were pretty militarized.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. This is, I think, an underappreciated aspect of what went on over the weekend in Charlottesville. The governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, who is a Democrat, said that there were camouflage-clad militia members that were toting assault rifles. They were standing outside the park. They looked like an invading army, he said. He said they had better equipment than our state police. This is according to an article that quotes him in the New York Times. This is a really astonishing thing that I think is worth taking a moment to think about because, you know, we have.
Right, forgive me, Sahil. We're going to have to hand off to. We're going to have to hear from President Trump, who's just started talking. Let's go right to it.
About trade policy and major tax cuts and reform. We are renegotiating trade deals and making them good for the American worker, and it's about time. Our economy is now strong. The stock market continues to hit record highs. Unemployment is at a 16-year low, and businesses are more optimistic than ever before. Companies are moving back to the United States and bringing many thousands of jobs with them. We have already created over 1 million jobs since I took office. We will be discussing economic issues in greater detail later this afternoon. But based on the events that took place over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, I would like to provide the nation with an update on the ongoing federal response to the horrific attack and violence that was witnessed by everyone. I just met with FBI Director Christopher Wray and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The Department of Justice has opened a civil rights investigation into the deadly car attack that killed one innocent American and wounded 20 others. To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, you will be held fully accountable. Justice will be delivered. As I said on Saturday, we condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. And as I have said many times before, no matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws. We all salute the same great flag, and we are all made by the same Almighty God. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal. We are equal in the eyes of our Creator. We are equal under the law. And we are equal under our Constitution. Those who spread violence in the name of bigotry strike at the very core of America. 2 days ago, a young American woman, Heather Heyer, was tragically killed. Her death fills us with grief, and we send her family our thoughts, our prayers, and our love. We also mourn the 2 Virginia State Troopers who died in service to their community, their commonwealth, and their country. Troopers Jay Cullen and Burke Bates exemplify the very best of America, and our hearts go out to their families, their friends, and every member of American law enforcement. These 3 fallen Americans embody the goodness and decency of our nation. In times such as these, America has always shown its true character, responding to hate with love, division with unity, and violence with an unwavering resolve for justice. As a candidate, I promise to restore law and order to our country, and our federal law enforcement agencies are following through on that pledge. We will spare no resource in fighting so that every American child can grow up free from violence and fear. We will defend and protect the sacred rights of all Americans, and we will work together so that every citizen in this blessed land is free to follow their dreams in their hearts and to express the love and joy in their souls. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you very much.
Mr. President.
Well, that was President Trump. He started off talking about trade deals and stock market highs, and he went to the federal response over what he characterized as the horrific and violent actions in Charlottesville, which we have been focusing on in this opening hour of Forum. And, well, I got to get a response right from you first, if I can, Sahil Kapoor. He actually named names. He said KKK. He said American Nazis.
Exactly. These are the words that I think the nation wanted to hear from the president 48 hours ago when he did his more equivocating remarks, essentially saying this was something that happens on many sides. On many sides, he said that word twice. 48 hours later, he says racism is evil. I'm going to quote the rest of it. He denounces the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. This was a clear statement from the president that I think is what people wanted to hear from him at the outset. Will there continue to be criticism for the fact that it took 2 days for him to say this? Absolutely. Will he get some praise from people who had wanted him to be clear at the outset? I think we can expect some of that too. And I think the hope of Republicans in particular is that they can finally stop talking about white supremacy and start talking about legislative items that they want to do.
Well, he also talked about the civil rights investigation being done by the DOJ, and he talked about the necessity for equality, and he talked a lot about love. What do you make out of this, Eva Patterson?
Well, good for Trump. I never thought I'd ever say those words, but good for him. He was clear, and he talked about racism and denounced white supremacy. My constant theme, though, is that the Justice Department is doing things like suppressing the black vote. If you haven't voted for 2 years, you're going to get kicked off the voting rolls. But for this moment, I need to just take a time out and say, good job, Donald Trump. I never thought I'd ever say that.
Well, what do you think is going to be the response, Professor Petey Simi, of those right-wing hatred groups?
Well, that's going to be interesting. We saw on the Daily Stormer, one of the main websites, hubs for these groups, a lot of support for his initial comments that created this false equivalency, and folks talking about the fact that he wasn't condemning them. So now he's running the risk of making folks unhappy. So I'm sure some of them will see this as a slap in the face of sorts. David Duke, reminded him via Twitter they're the ones who elected him, not leftist radicals. So I think we'll hear some of that among some of these folks, some unhappiness and displeasure with these comments. On the other hand, while the comments are exactly what needed to be said, this is the first step. And we'll see what comes next. Is Steve Bannon going to be removed? Because that would send an even bigger message about the condemnation of these kind of groups.
Yeah, although he may be removed more for the leaks than for his own affiliation.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I had to bring a little.
Whatever reasons those are, that would send a big message if he was no longer one of the chief advisors in the White House. And certainly these folks would be obviously very unhappy if Bannon was no longer serving in that capacity. So some of these folks may see this as something Trump needed to do. President Trump had to make this comment, and they may still hold, kind of a lot of faith that he's going to continue to do things that will be consistent with their vision.
Let me ask a quick question of you, if I may, Peter Simi, because I want to get to our callers. But Lynn has sent in an email to us asking how many police hold white nationalist views. Do you have any sense of that? Can you gauge that?
No, it's an issue. Definitely, these types of groups have been suggesting for decades now that, we need to grow our hair out, we need to cover up the tattoos or not get tattoos, and we need to get jobs in law enforcement, in medicine, in education. People need to go to school and get a degree and get into professional occupations so that they can essentially infiltrate society. And so these groups have seen law enforcement as one very important avenue to where they need to get people in there. There's a long-standing history of an overlap between these types of groups and law enforcement, unfortunately, in the United States. And so this has been a longstanding problem where groups like the Klan have had a strong presence in law enforcement.
I'm Peter Simi, professor of sociology at Chapman University and author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. And let me go to more of your calls. Let's go to Oakland. Steve, you're on.
Hey, thanks very much. Yeah, so I live in Oakland now, but I come from Charlottesville. And I have three daughters who were out in the streets as counter-protesters over the weekend. Fortunately, they're all safe. But I wanted to underline something that our Vice Mayor, Wes Bellamy, said, which is that this is not just about a statue, and this is not really a Civil War statue. The statue was erected in 1924 as part of Jim Crow. And that really sets the tone for what this is really about, which is a long history of the white community in Charlottesville trying to move the African-American community out of downtown and, in some cases, raising their houses and replacing them with statues to Civil War generals. This happened in the 20s. It happened again later in the 1960s. Charlottesville was very active in what was called massive resistance, which was an effort to – the Charlottesville white community was – which was an effort to resist school desegregation. They literally took their white kids out of the public schools and taught them in churches, church basements, to avoid having to comply with rules around integration. So there's a long history in Charlottesville of the white community working hard to move the black community out and to marginalize them. And I think it's important that we see this as part of that, because the man that we saw was terrible. It was, it was tragic. It was horrible. But systemic racism over a long period of time is even more horrible, and it's often much more subtle and much harder to see. But the long-term damage is much worse.
All right. I thank you for those comments, Steve. Let me let them stand. And actually, Eva, you had said, Eva Patterson, earlier that a lot of the statues came up after the 60s. Mm-hmm. I think he's right about the Robert E. Lee statue. I think
the
it
20s.
Was probably
mm-hmm.
in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Russ writes, I agree with almost everything Ms. Patterson says. However, all the violent left-wing groups that only feed the white supremacist movement and alienate average Americans lead to events like the election of Trump.
Most people I know on the left are not violent. We have a First Amendment right to go out and protest, and many people have been out protesting lots of things. There are some knuckleheads who will come and cause trouble, but all the people I know who are activists are not violent.
Well, these so-called anarchists, they were out there, weren't they? Let me go back to you on this, Bert Johnson. I mean, like you said, it was fairly peaceful, except for, defacing concrete and stopping traffic and those kinds of things, which actually annoys the hell out of a lot of people. But you saw some of them there, and yet they weren't necessarily doing what they were doing in previous riots.
Yeah, that's right. I think you know, there's a lot of confusion about, like, which groups people who join Black Blocs come from. Generally speaking, it's important to keep in mind that it's actually typically a pretty wide coalition of, you know, people on the left, including anarchists, but also other groups. But I do want to take a moment to really point out that an important difference here is that people like Nathan D'Amigo not only have these very earnest beliefs where they want to create a separate white homeland, but they're also very violent themselves. Nathan D'Amigo, for instance, served 4 years in prison.
He held up a cab driver at gunpoint, right?
That's right, a Middle Eastern cab driver in San Diego.
He thought he was an Iraqi or something like that.
That's what he said during his defense. And then later on, more recently, he really became – he went viral within the far right for punching a young woman in the face.
Yeah.
And that's been videotaped. You know, different correspondents from different news agencies have said that they saw it go down. So he's got this very earnest belief that he's actively trying to recruit people for in hopes of building a long-term, stable movement to advocate for creating these ethno-states. And all of that may be a little academic, but in the near term, he and his group are actively seeking confrontation and engaging in violence themselves.
Can you also give us a brief sense of what happened over in Berkeley with this Top Dog employee? I mean, he was fired for being in fact, thousands tweeted his picture as being part of the Charlottesville demonstration of the protesters and essentially the Unite Right movement, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Cole White is who everyone suspects that person to be. As you said, a Twitter account tweeted a picture of him with his name and where he worked, which was Top Dog. And he's someone that I've personally seen engaging in violence at some of these Berkeley so-called free speech rallies in April specifically. So he is another local figure in this dangerous movement.
I didn't know about the violence, but you get into this whole area of should people be fired for their political beliefs, even if they're, you know, beliefs that are repulsive to the person who is employing them. We had that whole thing go on with Google and Damore and so forth. But let me bring some more of our callers in here. We go next to Carrie in San Jose. Join us.
Hi. Good morning. I wanted to know how much your guests think what we're seeing is symptomatic of rising inequality with groups like working class whites and people of color being pitted against one another somewhat through public policy that's contributing to rising inequality.
Yeah, Eva Patterson.
As I was driving over here today, I was thinking that, and I was thinking about the fault for some of this lies with the Democrats. And I was thinking when in 2008, when the economy was imploding, the Democrats and Obama gave all that money to the banks, and they didn't give money to homeowners and people who were losing their homes. I remember Paul Krugman screaming from the pages of the New York Times, jobs, 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 jobs. Many of the working class white people are being left behind, but so are working class brown African-American and Asian-American people as well. And what I was thinking about driving over here is that one of the greatest kind of dividing tactics that the people in power have used is, well, you may be poor, but you're not black. And I think that's part of what's going on here, too. And when you have a black family in the White House, I think that freaked a lot of white people out. There's social science research that shows as there's increasing diversity, many white people feel threatened. They feel the social order is upended. So to the extent that our economy is not helping working class people of all colors, I think that creates a fertile ground for people like Trump and white nationalists to recruit people.
Well, the young man who was being charged, and let me go to you on this, if I may, Peter Simi, it was essentially a failure in terms of his service in the Army. And you have so many of these stories across the Atlantic, too, of people who are either have prison records or are out of work or can't find work or, you know, or I suppose by, in fact, President Trump's standards, losers of one sort or another. I use that word that he uses a lot. What did you find in terms of just, you know, the disassociation from not being able to find work or not being able to find steady work among these hate groups?
Well,
you know, we it's certainly a factor, although one of the things that happens is people get involved, and that actually adversely, you know, in these types of groups, they get involved in the groups, and that ends up leading to greater downward economic mobility. So a tough time finding job, keeping jobs, partly because of the lifestyles can be very unstable, and oftentimes people are involved in substance abuse and so forth. But as far as the entry process in, what we actually find more in terms of, rather than economic kind of risk factors, we find a lot of other types of problems in people's lives growing up in childhood and adolescence that make them vulnerable to the messages of these groups. They you know, experience lots of problems in terms of child abuse, sexual abuse, substance abuse in the family, a lot of kind of familial instabilities and dysfunctions and so forth. And it creates, you know, some real emotional and social kind of deficiencies and vulnerabilities, and these groups provide an outlet of sorts, social camaraderie and so forth, that allow them to kind of latch on to something, connect to something, and try and create some kind of meaning in their lives when they're otherwise kind of faltering.
So often the reason young people join gangs, very similar phenomenon.
Very similar.
Yeah.
A lot of overlap. Yeah.
And Peter Simi, thank you for being with us. That's going to bring us to a conclusion here. Thank you, Eva Patterson.
Glad to be here.
And thank you, Sahil Kapoor.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks, Bert Johnson.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to find out all about tribal justice. Yes, there are Indian tribes who actually made out justice and do it in conjunction with courtrooms. There's a movie about it. We're going to look at it in the hour coming ahead. That's one segment. We're going to have another segment as well, and I hope you will join us up ahead. Stay tuned for all that. We're going to meet a new author, in fact, when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.